Hello friends, I'm your host Chris Thrall. I'm a former Royal Marines Commando. I've adventured, for better and sometimes worse, across 80 countries on all 7 continents. Welcome to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast.
We were attacked by aircraft, and actually, well, let's put this into context. When we completed the Yomp and we got up into the mountains, a place called Mount Kent, we were on the what's called the reverse slope, i.e. the side opposite to where the enemy is, in dead ground. We stopped, and there was a huge resupply there. I don't know how the RSM had managed to do this, but he got ahead of the unit, and I remember him stood on top of it, Pat Chapman, with his SLR guarding it and issuing stuff out as we filed past. We went into defence. We didn't dig trenches because the ground was impossible. It was all rock. So you kind of built sangers or got into nooks and crannies. It was, you know, it wasn't the conventional thing. Adapt, of course, as you always do. We had one night there where we got bombed by something. I believe a big bomb was chopped off the back of a Hercules, which was a near miss, funny enough. And the following night, I was told, right, you're going forward and you're going to set up independently, you know, to harass the enemy. Cause casualties and harass the enemy. That was the generic mission. It took 16 hours to move 4,000 meters. We had a proper Antarctic gale right on the nose, perfect cover for what we were doing. And on the way to this position I was looking for in the dark, which was just a spot on the map, we came across the position that the Argies had abandoned when the BBC World Service, you know, warned them off that we were about to attack Goose Green. They left all their kit behind, which was a great prof for us. We got lots of onions and tins of corned beef and stuff like that. And we also found some operational overlays, which basically solved the war's problems with intelligence. That was a huge coup for which Corporal Hanna, who found that, never got any recognition. But anyway, we struggled to this place overnight, and we set up a base in the middle of nowhere in the rocks. We had to keep below ground, as it were, during the daytime. But we had 16 hours of darkness, moving into the austral winter.
Andy, could you speak up a bit? I don't know why we've lost a bit of volume. I'm just conscious of the people that will be listening on iTunes will be.
Sure, mate. Yeah, I'll speak a bit louder. How's that?
That's much better. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah,
perhaps I'm falling asleep. Well, I have heard this story before, you see. Not that I'm bored. No. Anyway, stop waffling. Let's get on with it. There I was in this forward operating base in no man's land, well forward of the unit, 4,000 meters in front. With 3 para on my left flank, 4-2 commando, a long way off on the right flank, and just the enemy. To cause the casualties, we just brought down fire missions. And it was a bizarre observation that once you dropped a fire mission, the enemy would go up and inspect the craters. I mean, you just repeat. It was unbelievable. You know, I couldn't believe these people were so basic. By this time, of course, with everything that had been going on beforehand, we'd lost any kind of sympathy for the enemy. So there was no emotional connection with what we were doing. Let's put it that way. I think it's fair to say we were probably sort of two-dimensional, focused on the job, and that's it. By the way, I never take anything to war with me. No photographs or nothing. You know, I don't have any mementos from home. Home stays at home, and war's war, and you don't mix the two, sort of thing. During the night, we were doing these long recce patrols. That was our primary function, was to find out what was actually there. And it took a while because of the minefield threat. You know, that was another mind concentrating experience with no detectors of any sort. And the Argies didn't mark their mines, so we had no idea where they were or what they had. The only information we had came from Jane's, of course, you know, the publication that deals with all the world's armed forces. But personal knowledge, very little. So, and also information wasn't filtering down from what had been learned at Goose Green at this point. It never reached us. So we didn't learn any lessons from, you know, what was currently there. However, at the end of that time, I was told, right, you're now going to conduct a fighting patrol onto the objective, which is this mountain called Two Sisters. And your mission is to find their mortar positions and to destroy them. Now, this is a boy's own task. This is exactly what you trained for. This is what you've hoped for. But I don't want to give the impression that I was sort of leaping around for joy. It was actually a very sobering thing to be told, because the risk for it was very high. There was a strong possibility that some of us weren't going to make it. And up to this point, we'd more, apart from losing the radio operator through wrecking his ankles, we'd been very lucky. A normal battle procedure took place, full battle procedure. I've never cut any corners with this. Even in Ireland, where you did repetitive patrols for 6 months, every single time went through the whole thing, the proper orders process and And this, of course, was the greatest challenge I'd ever faced. And I had the biggest command I'd ever had, not just in terms of people. I was 42 because I had four engineers attached to me whose function was to destroy their mortars. I had a section, four guys from recce troop who were going to aid us by acting as scouts. I had a mortar fire controller controlling a section of our own mortars. And I also had a mortar forward observation officer who was controlling the entire gun line of 2-9 commandos. So I had a pretty awesome firepower. I felt confident, but the risks, as I say, were very high. My biggest fear was getting caught out on the extraction phase, which we had to extract by the same route in, which is normally a no-no, but we didn't have the flexibility to do anything other than that. And I could see us getting caught perhaps in a minefield in daylight between two enemy positions with no Kazovac, because there was no Kazovac compared to what we're used to today. That was my greatest fear. Anyway, it didn't happen. We did the full battle procedure, which included night rehearsals, although did the night rehearsals slightly early before it got actually dark, because I wanted to maximize on the darkness as much as possible. And just before we left, a Gazelle helicopter flew up to my location, which was an absolute no-no because he's basically compromised us. But he didn't stop. He just went to the hover and he handed me a piece of paper, literally stuck his hand out the window and vanished. And it came straight from our int and it said, beware of a thing called 601 Commando that's in the area. Carry on with the mission. Don't cut the phone lines to Stanley. And because we were going so far beyond the range of everything, this section of mortar troop, our own mortar troop, call sign 56 Bravo, had been sent forward to give us support. And just before it got dark, I actually saw them moving a couple hundred meters away towards their position, the intended position. So I knew that they were in the area. It got dark and we set off. And more as straight away, I had to go to the front where the lead scout was and tell him to speed up. He was going too slow. You know, the one old adage is always take your risks early when you're doing this kind of thing. And we knew the ground anyway. He was naturally cautious, but we didn't have the time. So he speeded up a bit. About 1 hour later, we got to the first RV, RV1, which was the end of a stone run. But before we actually stopped and went into the procedure for the RV, we actually halted suddenly and everybody got down. It was pitch dark, couldn't see my hand in front of my face. We had a full moon. It was on the rise all the way through that week. But on this particular night, a total cloud cover, couldn't see anything. And we had none of us, except for the recce troop scout, had a night sight. So it was just the Mark One eyeball. Anyway, so this guy sent the message, boss on me sort of thing. I crawled up to the front and he handed over his weapon. I looked through his sight and now I could see this blob. I wasn't sure what it was. And because the old first generation night sights were very basic, they relied on ambient light, starlight, and we had none. So without that, virtually useless. But he had seen something. And as I watched this blob, I started seeing it moving and I realized it was a group of people. And then suddenly a light came on and that confirmed it. So the next few minutes at the most, possibly seconds, were very, very fast. I then sent out through the various channels to the section commanders, prepare for an ambush. This is a hasty ambush. Through zero, go back to our CP, command post, check that there's nobody out from three para who are on our left flank. The inter-unit boundary, there was nothing on the ground. It was just a line on the map. Very, very dangerous. Check the guns are ready. They're unmasked if we need them, which we probably will. And also, where's that mortar section? Are they ready to support us as well? So while all this was going on, I was still looking through this night sight and I could see this group starting to break up and they were starting to move. And they were starting to move towards us. So now the speed was moving very, very fast. Or maybe it's frozen. I can't, it's a long time ago, but your memory is very selective of certain things. It's interesting how there are gaps. But anyway, I clearly remember seeing them coming towards us, and by now we'd all shuffled around to cover the arcs of this, what was now a hasty ambush. We had rehearsed this, I think, if I remember rightly. So, there was no orders required. It was all hand signals. And the drill was, when the last man of this force is within the arc, the recce scout will tap me on the shoulder and that will tell me he's there, and I'll initiate by firing a shimuli. What became obvious was that they weren't on a sort of reciprocal parallel bearing, because one of the thoughts that ran through my mind is let them go, let somebody else deal with this. This is not our task. But that was quickly squashed by the other side, the dark side, if you like. And I thought, no, these are the bastards that have caused all this. We're going to kill them. But that decision wasn't even a 50-50 because it was very clear that they were actually on a converging bearing. They were going to step on the rear of us. The front man was suddenly going to discover us and the element of surprise would be lost. So there was no option here. That was fortunate. As they were moving in front, I could start to hear movement. I could hear their waterproofs, frankly. Swish, swish, swish. Bits of kick, clicking and things like this. And through the sight, I couldn't identify anything. All I could just see was vague figures. Then I got the tap on the shoulder. I fired the Shamuli. As soon as I fired it, I knew I'd done the wrong thing because the drill, as you probably remember, Chris, is that if light goes up very close, you hit the deck instantly. If it goes up at a distance, you freeze and you just go down with the shadows. And I, in that sort of 2 second pause between firing this thing and it popping, I just expected everything to vanish. Well, when it popped, of course, it didn't happen. There were 21 figure 11 targets frozen directly in front of us. The shock effect was so, they must have all been, what the hell was that? And that was it. Down it went. I kept putting the light up. The feeling of relief, having done the hardest thing in my life, pulling that trigger in cold blood. The great fear that this was the point section of a commando attack. There could be 650 enemy right here that I can't see. We're about to get rolled up. All this kind of stuff going through your mind, and it flashes through in seconds from one end of the spectrum to the other. It's incredible how the brain runs so fast, which is why there's sometimes confusion afterwards. Mm. And then a kind of feeling of elation. I could hear the screaming. We'd obviously hit targets. And that, incidentally, from a PTSD point of view, is why I could never cope with my daughter's crying, because it's the same sound. And then I ran out of light, and it went dark, and all the firing stopped. And in that sudden, horrible silence, I heard a British voice shout, "Stop firing, we're 5-6 Bravo." And that's when I realized this wasn't the enemy at all. This was our own mortar section we just ambushed. And that was the moment when my life changed. You know, the before and after bit, there's two distinct halves to my life. And that was the exact moment. And that was about 12:30 on the 10th, I think it was, of June, 1982. It took the rest of the night to sort out. We'd killed four and very seriously injured three more. I was ordered to carry on with the mission. I disobeyed that order. And practically because there wasn't enough light left, or darkness rather, we would never have achieved it. But the main reason was I wasn't up for it. The troop would have obeyed orders. Obviously, if I'd said we're going, there would have been some grunting and muttering, I'm sure, but we'd have cracked on, but I couldn't do it. So we went back to the harbour, and I said to my troop sergeant, "I don't want anybody on sentry tonight. I don't want anybody sitting here fiddling with the triggers, thinking about what's just happened." And I turned in. I'm sure he did the right thing, whatever that was. I've got no idea, but probably he just ignored me that. And a very short while after, a helicopter arrived as we stood down and took me back to Commando HQ for a debrief. All I met was sympathy. There was massive understanding. We'd unfortunately done the job very professionally. And unfortunately, our victims had made some mistakes. They'd basically got lost, or they'd rather overshot, to be precise. They weren't totally lost, but they weren't exactly where they should have been. And in that kind of situation, that is not the time to sort of mislead people. When asked, were they on high ground? The answer was yes. In fact, we were all on low ground. I think they were fudging it. And they were moving fast in front of me because the realization had sunk in that we need them and they need to get to their intended position, which unfortunately they'd overshot, which is why they were coming from the wrong direction. So it's so easy to misread situations. And in moments like that, when you've literally got seconds to make decisions, you know, it's impossible. And a blue-on-blue is something that happens in every single conflict. And all of them have those kind of elements in them somewhere. You know, one little thing leads to something bigger and so on, a chain of events that suddenly you're out of, you know, that you're no longer controlling. And that situation, I was definitely out of control. Once we'd initiated, that was it. So the debrief lasted about 15 minutes, if that. There was a lot of hugging and a few tears. And then the CO said, "Right, well, get back shore. The big day's arrived. Tonight we're going to attack. You know, you'll be getting your orders. Stand by for that." And that was it. And that was the very last thing ever anything was ever said about that particular event. I went back to the group and we carried on.
Friends, thank you for listening to the Bought the T-Shirt podcast. Please like, subscribe and share. And don't forget to follow me on social media. Username, Chris Thrall. Instagram, Chris.Thrall. Thank you.